Hi, thank you, everyone. My name is Dee. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Thank you for welcoming me to your home group, and thanks, Rich, for asking me to speak. I don't really know what your normal format is, but I am very different for everything. So my head is ADHD. I go all over the place, and I'm going to do that with the book. So if you guys can just keep up with me, if that's okay, that's how I'm going to start. And pretty much I'm going to start with the doctor's opinion, because I love that part of the doctor's opinion has promises in there. And it starts, we always hear about the 9-step promises. There's promises in every step. And the book has many, many promises in there, but everyone always talks about the 9-step promises. I like to address all the different ones that are in there, because there are promises that have not come true to me, and there are some that have come to fruition already without having to get to that 9-step. And, you know, I like to start that way because that's a message of hope. It's like, okay, you know, maybe long term I didn't get to that destination, but right here at this pit stop, there's something here I can pick up. It's good. So that's why I like to go all in, and you're going to know I'm going to go all over the place. So, but anyway, starting with the doctor's opinion, you know, he starts off and he's talking about how we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed a return to health. Well, who are they talking about there? They're talking about the hospitals, and this is the doctor who's talking about, you know, his experiences so far from these people that, you know, back then they weren't alcoholics. They were just throwaways, right? I'm a throwaway, and glad to be one, because I've been recycled and repurposed. But so that's what he's talking about, how he's seen something happen. There's some sort of a recovery that has come from somebody else, this plan of recovery, and it has helped these throwaways. So he writes the letter, right? And then in the letter he says, this man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Right there is giving you, hey, look, you can recover. All you have to do is read a little bit about this, but right there is your first promise. This man and the other 100 can recover. My parents, my family, everybody else, the DMV says we're not going to recover, right? But no, this book is telling us right off the bat. And it's not telling you at the middle of the book. It's not telling you at the end. It's right in the first chapter, we will recover. So that for me was the big enlightenment. And I love having people start when we do studies and I'm taking them through their steps. We start from there because I want to start with the hope. We're already coming in with baggage. We're coming in with all of our low self-esteem problems, everything else. I want to start with something that's going to give us hope to carry out as we leave. So that's what I like about when he starts there. And then he talks about the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as of its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, and ex-problem drinkers are the real alcoholics, right? Not just casual social drinkers. We're talking about people who drank like me. So as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Now, if you're reading about this and you don't really have a chronic alcoholic problem the way they're talking about with this allergy, you're not going to be able to identify as well. You will greatly get a message out of it. I tell everybody to read this book because either way, you'll get a message of recovery. But for us who are the ex-problem drinkers he's talking about, you can identify more with what he's talking about. And it says, though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as the altruistic plane. Okay, so when I was reading this book, I can barely put thoughts together, let alone words together, and then in this language, no. So I have a dictionary, and I put little footnotes on the side of my dictionary, right, on my book. So altruistic plane means helping others, show concern for the welfare of others. That's altruism. That was foreign to me in so many ways. Not only the word, but the actions. That was not me. When did I ever put anybody ahead of me? Only when it was because they had to get in trouble. Yeah, I'll throw you under the bus. Go right ahead. Go right in front of me. But aside from that, no. Absolutely not. And he's saying that there is a solution. It's based on the spiritual as well as this altruistic plane. Okay? I'm listening. We favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be clear before he is approached, and he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. I have new sponsees, and I tell them at the very beginning, you hear a lot in meetings, shut up, listen, take the cotton out of your ears, put them in your mouth. I would rather have them and instruct them to this. Wait till you have clarity, ask questions when you can. I think it's important for you to ask questions. How are you going to go to a meeting as a newcomer? Not know anything and not know how to identify, because at this point, when I first walk into the room, I don't even know what a true alcoholic is. I know I'm here because I need help. And I'm at my lowest. I really can't picture anything else that can go wrong in my life, pretty much. And that's my motivation. Everything was going wrong, so I figured, all right, I'm going to do something so it'll start turning right, because I had the Midas touch in reverse. Everything I touched turned into manure, and that's it. I said, okay, I can't live like this anymore. So now when I'm taking a newcomer, I'm pretty sure they can identify with that feeling. You came in, you feel the same way I did. I'm sure you feel like the whole world is collapsing around you. So when I get into a room, and he says that you have to have a little bit of clear-headedness, right, and not be jittery. For those people who I find are jittery and in need of detox, I would recommend they go to detox first, and then we can get together and come up with whatever the solution is going to be. For those who are not in that phase, which is what he's talking about, then we can start with reading this book and talk about a solution. But if you're still in that befogged moment that he's talking about, it's like talking to air. It's really not going to, you're not going to really be able to connect with it the way you would once you know a little bit more and you have that sense of clarity. On page 27 of the doctor's opinion, I have underlined, many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas, which he put into practical applications at once. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing, and unselfishness of these men who have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive. There's the altruism they're talking about, right? And their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who is labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in a power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. Doesn't that sound right there like there's a promise? You're believing in something that can bring you back from the gates of death. When we come in here, we just figure our life is over. Your sentence, you're done. Okay, you're labeled an alcoholic. Your life is over. You're never going to party again. You're never going to have anything again. And I have to do whatever these people tell me and I'm done. No. We get back. It's going to pull us back from the gates of hell. Our life is about to get better than we even thought what life was supposed to be about. That's why they say better than your wildest dream. Because we can't even dream of what we don't even know about. So, the next page on paragraph 2, where he talks about the frothy emotional appeal, I have highlighted, in nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. I have that highlighted and underlined as step one. Because I have to believe in something bigger than me, right? When you first come in and you're not familiar with all of these things, it's the meeting. It's the fellowship in the meeting. That's a power greater than me. You know, I have my camaraderie, and if I'm feeling a little bit in my head, I call up and I get to call somebody else who's going to know. You're going to be able, you're the only people that will identify with me no matter where I am. If I call somebody else who does not have the same addiction or the same, not necessarily addiction, but even the same thoughts, you're not going to be able to identify. You're not going to be able to understand or comprehend what I'm talking about. And sometimes all I say is a couple of words, and I have sponsees do that to me all the time. They're like, blah, blah. I understood that. You understood what I just said? Yes. I understood your jargon. You know why? Because I spoke it. So we need to surrender first into something else, and that's where that first step comes in. And for me, I believe that my first step was when I came into the meeting. And when I came in, it was because I came in willingly for myself, not because I was court-appointed, not because my significant other, my kids. No, I went because I wanted to. And that's when I genuinely made my first step. And I said, okay, I need help. Okay, and then he says at the bottom of that same page, the last paragraph, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. How true is that for me? First off, it says in the preamble, you know, we have to be honest to be able to achieve this recovery that we're seeking. I don't know what honesty is. When I first came in, I wasn't honest. I lied as a child because there were things that I used to omit and I used to get away with it. And then, you know, all of a sudden, omissions became full-fledged lies. And that gray line for me disappeared. I had no idea which is which. So I don't know what honesty is. Somebody needs to help me and teach me comprehend what is honesty. Because I can tell you, all right, I'm going to call you back in 25 minutes. I intend to. May not call you back till the next day, or maybe you'll reach out to me. Hey, you said you were going to call me back. I did. I'm so sorry. I forgot. Did you really forget? That's up to your own scrutiny. But I know for me, there are some times that I will remember, oh, man, I was supposed to call her back 2 minutes ago. I don't want to call her now. It's too late. That's where that honesty comes in. But I call because I gave my word. And one thing that we do learn in here is that we have to be accountable. Words have power. And we want people to judge us and see us in a different light than what they did before. So the only proof that they have is our actions. So if anything, even if it's something as simple as saying, oh yeah, I meant to call you back and it was late, I'll be honest. Listen, I got tired. I'm sorry. I didn't want to call you at that hour. But I'll be honest. I have to tell on myself. I have to always keep an honest program. And the reason I'm using this example so much is because it is elaborate for me. Because like I said at the beginning, I did not know the difference between lies, honesty, and just trying to be nice. I didn't know. And it's not really quite as black and white as they say. But yeah, it really is. It really is. All it is, you know, anything, like my sponsor says, keep it really simple. Anything after but, it's redundant. If you know there's a but after that, it's all a lie. He told me right off the bat. Anything after but is a lie. So quit before you get to that but. Okay, so to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless they can gain experience, the sense of ease and comfort when it comes by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see taking others taking with impunity. There's another word that was, okay, impunity. And I go to meetings all the time. People read these things and nobody asks, well, you know what? I'm that person. What does impunity mean? So I looked it up. Freedom from problems. Wow, what a perfect word for exactly what my alcohol does for me. It frees me from problems. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over unless the person can experience an entire psychic change. There is very little hope for his recovery. And that's one of the reasons why I said you have to have the capacity to be honest. Once you have the capacity to be honest and say, I'm doing this for me. Not even saying I'm not drinking because I don't know if I'm going to drink again tomorrow. I'm still at the very beginning when I'm first making this commitment. But all I know is that when I walk through the door, my first step is I want to do this for me. I am hoping not to drink. And they say, you know what, sometimes it's a minute at a time. We only have a 24-hour day, right? So we do it by the day. And sometimes break it down to 10 minutes for some people. It depends. Call me back in 10 minutes. All right, if you still feel like that, call me back in 20 minutes. And we'll continue to expand it. But that impunity that they're seeking is not going to be there. Once you take that, it's not going to disappear within those same 20 minutes. So how about we wait and try something different for the first time ever? So he says, on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, that was me, who had so many problems he despaired over ever solving, suddenly finds himself easily and able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. That's all we got to do, a few simple rules. At the beginning was the six tenets from the Oxford group. Then Bill and the first 100, they got down to it. They were able to write this book, and they came up with 12 suggestions. Right? The simple rules. And we're going to be able to get into those. Many have cried out to me in sincere, despairing appeal, Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it often is not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit that we have made little impression upon this problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. Now, what he's talking about here is that phenomenon that Bill had right off the bat with that white light experience, we don't all get that. So the psychological approach is what in the spiritual experience they talk about. There's people that have that spiritual experience right off the bat, and then there are those that have the intellectual experience, which is what I had. And psychologically speaking, that's how it was broken down to me. Because when I first removed myself from all of my addictions, now I'm dealing with a sober D. And a sober D now has all of these issues that, because I have dual diagnosis, that I really never dealt with before because they were always numb. So now I have, I'm undergoing psychiatric treatment. I'm diagnosed with a plethora of initials, and they give me medications that are helping me to rationalize what's going on right in front of me, to better grasp. And once I do that, for me right now, that also was a higher power. The doctor. Because you had to keep it very low for me at first. Don't go straight to God. I know God was behind it. But right at that moment, okay, it was the doctor. And the doctor was starting to give me clarity because I know that my head was just in worse than befogged. I can't even say I was in a turmoil. So once I was able to begin to find a calm after the storm, because my head was still in that storm, now I'm starting to get clear thoughts, enough where I can put together words as to what I'm feeling, which I could never do before. Because you see, my disease wanted you to know automatically what's wrong with me without me having to tell you. And you're supposed to solve my problem. Don't you have like something that you can read my mind without me having to tell you anything and me having to get out of my pride to let you guys know what's going on? Because now I'm even more in my pride because you don't know what's going on with me and I'm having a resentment against you because you're not even asking. And I can do this fight oh my gosh, I could tear it over the end and then and then and then. And that's how I was. Until finally I was able to get that that clarity and depend upon something or someone else. So that power was no longer me. There is the type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is a manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. That was me, the manic depressive type. And I love that it said that, a whole chapter. I can add on to it, I'm sure. But then again, here it is about me, right? Then there are types entirely normal in every respect, except the effect of the alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, and friendly people. Well, here's some good news right here. We're alcoholics, we're the throwaways, right? When we first come in here. And then you're telling me in here that often most of us are able, intelligent, and friendly people. But when you go out there to the calamity, that's what calamity is, right? It's all the other noises from over there. Everybody's telling you what a throwaway you are, how disposable you are, and your life is a mess. You read this book and it's right. It has not even at the beginning. We're not even in the first chapter yet. And it's telling you, there are many of us who, guess what? We're smart. We're pretty good people. So that, you know, that is one of the wonderful things that I like about identifying with this book. And when people say, you're one of those, yes, I am proud of it. Yes, I am. Says about 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. What's chronic alcoholism? Is that a person who could drink at a party and then they overdid it and the next day they go and they go to a party again and then that's it, they're done? Is that the chronic alcoholic or is it the one that wakes up and we're thinking about it? Which party am I going to that's going to have the open bar? And let me pre-up and pre-game and do all... I think that... for me, is the chronic alcoholic. But you know what? That description is subject to every person differently. But for me, that's what I was. The chronic, because I was already thinking of pre-gaming, post-gaming, where I'm going to go, where I could crash, because I know I was going to be too trash, because I'm already planning that far in ahead. That I don't have to worry about. So now, if you're planning where you're going to crash, because you know that you're not going to be able to drive, or you're not going to, you already know that you're an alcoholic. Because it didn't matter that I had kids at home waiting for me. It didn't matter any of those other things, that I have to be at work in the morning. It didn't matter. None of those things mattered. Right now, my main concern is, all right, let me set up my game plan. I'll get a babysitter for them. This way I don't look like the flunky mother of the year, and go about my business. And as I'm doing all of this, this takes a lot of work and energy. But that's why I believe, you know, I am the chronic alcoholic. When it was read back to me like that and I identified, yes, I am the chronic alcoholic. A normal alcoholic can go to a party and the next day and they're not worrying about where they're going to crash, where they're going to sleep over, who's going to take care of their... They're not thinking of any of that. A regular person who can drink, they go to the party, they come home, and what? Nice. We had a nice time. That's not me. I've never experienced that in my life. It would be nice, you know. I'm not one of those pinkies out. That just wasn't for me. So he says he had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. That's the chronic alcoholic, all right? He frankly admitted and believed that for him, there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked to him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed, and he has not returned to alcohol. Now they're talking about Hank Parker there, who you can refer to the chapter of the employers. This is the alcoholic they're talking about in the chapter of the employers. But for me, what stands out about this is he recovered. He said he's it's like night and day from what it was before to what it is now. He said he somewhat resembled the person that he treated before, but aside from that, something changed. They're alluding here to that entire psychic change that happens to us when we choose to do these steps, when we choose to take these suggestions. And it's funny because, you know, you're reading here, here's the doctor, and the doctor says he doesn't look anything like the person he treated the year before. Well, you can imagine, you know, when I first came in, I was yellow. I looked like, I'm sure, crap. And people who see me later, I'll be knock wood coming on 11 years. People who see me now that I haven't seen since my very first meeting, they say that there's something different about me. I'm like, no, I don't know what they're talking about. But they all do. And everybody always says you have this glow. I believe that. I got that glow when I committed to my third step. Most of it was because I released all control. I'm not in charge of the show anymore. The minute you did that, all my tension went like this. I'm so tired. I am so tired of doing everything. So tired of running the show. Then I have to account for what setbacks may happen, and I'm planning in advance for that. And there's so many things that it's tiring. It's exhausting. I don't want to do this anymore. So I do a step three, and I find a power greater than me. And mine is God. And it's God as you understood him. It doesn't matter if it's a maple tree. It doesn't matter if it's Mother Nature. It doesn't matter if it's a goddess. It just says the God as you understood him. So I did that, and I was able to feel that mental uplift. Okay. I want to go to page 52. To talk about those lovely bedevilments. Because I love the bedevilments. So it says on the second paragraph, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view. We are having problems with personal relationships. Now, when I read these bedevilments, I'm asking myself, as opposed to saying what it says here, and whenever I'm sponsoring somebody, I do the same thing. I said, am I having trouble with personal relationships? Can't I control my emotional natures? Am I prey to misery and depression? Can I make a living? I'm asking all of these questions, okay? Because these, for me, were qualifiers of my spiritual disease. Not necessarily alcoholism, but my spiritual disease. And that's a big thing, because we come in for the absence and be able to live without the alcohol, but to have that whole new life that they're promising, we have to come to believe that, okay, first let me diagnose myself and say I have to admit I have these things to then be able to surrender it all to somebody. So once I asked myself all of those questions, I wrote down in bookmarks, it's the spiritual component of an alcoholic. All of these bedevilments are the spiritual component of an alcoholic. When we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas did not work, but the God idea did. It goes on now to talk about how we blindly... It talks about the Wright brothers, and basically within that, you know, they took their first flight, and to be able to do that, you have to have faith, right? You're not going to just go ahead and jump off this thing and hope it's going to fly. You have faith that it's going to fly. You're not thinking about, oh, I'm going to go and kill myself right now. So when he's relaying all of these stories about the Wright brothers and their childhood faith, I can get on with that, because back when we're talking about Bill's story, he talks about when he was a child going to church with his grandfather. And it's that same childlike faith. Then life happens, and all of a sudden, all of that gets... Because when we're all little, they all say, do you believe in Santa Claus, right? If you behave, Santa Claus is going to bring you gifts. Everybody's heard that, I'm sure, whether you believe or you don't. And when you're little, you're so pure. That faith is easy to believe. Life gets in the way with all of that pomp, calamity, all of the things that they talk about in the book, and that's what takes away our innocence. And once you take away all of that purity and all of that innocence, you start to become the other end, where you're in charge as opposed to relying and having that faith upon something. But it's never too late. That's the great thing about this book. We can still get that back. It says in here that deep down within every one of us is the fundamental idea of God. That's the same little child that we have inside of us that once believed in Santa Claus, that once believed in the Tooth Fairy. That same child is in there. We just have to get reconnected with that child, because that child has been put dormant. We've heard them, because you always have, and I always tell my friends this. I say, you know, when you went out on your last hurrah, did you have an instinct that you said, you know, all day? Because I know with me, I had an annoying bad gut instinct that kept saying, you shouldn't go. You shouldn't go. I don't want to go, but I'm going to go. And I went, and I almost got arrested. I always call that my God instinct. I never listen to my gut instinct. I always second guess it. And every time I second guess it, something goes wrong. I always call that my God instinct. That day that I did not follow my God instinct, yet again, everything went to hell in a handbasket. It was horrible. But it was exactly how it was supposed to be. Because that's what led me to where I am today. He says, we agnostically inclined would not feel satisfied with a proposal which does not lend itself to reasonable approach and interpretation. Hence, we are at pains to tell why we think our present faith is reasonable, why we think it is more sane and logical to believe that there's not than to believe that there may be. Why we say our former thinking was soft and mushy when we threw up our hands in doubt and said, we don't know. That's going back to that innocent child-like faith that we had. All right? And when we grow up, we start to think, yeah, you know, that's being ignorant, that's being naive. No. Yes, there is naivety to that. There is ignorance, but there's also that lack of faith that was once there when I was that child. And it doesn't. It's not until you sit down and try to do these proposals. Before I take anyone to a step three, I do what my sponsor did for me. And I have a three-subject notebook, which he told me to get. And on my third subject, he says, do me a favor, write down any miracles that may have happened to you. Miracles? Just some unexplained or inexplicable events that happened that they shouldn't have happened, but they happen anyway. I'm too far down in my disease. You think I'm going to look for a miracle right now? So I start writing things down, and I'm going to read you some of my miracles. Because it wasn't until I was able to get down to the miracle that I was able to get reconnected with that faith. So my first miracle was I'm sober and I'm alive after a car accident, which took place right after my back surgery. I was driving home from a meeting. I got T-boned. And I had just come out of back surgery. So if I would have gotten inflammation or anything else, I could have been left paralyzed. I didn't. And I made it home. And I'm still in that mindset, that sick mindset. Here I am again with that Midas touch, right? What else? Now I lost my car. I'm in crutches. I can't work. And now here's this too. Now I have somebody in third party saying, but you didn't become paralyzed. It's so simple. You just said that. Yeah, I was too busy focusing in the part that I could have that I didn't realize I'm not. I was at a meeting one day, and my mom has Alzheimer's. And I was getting text messages, and I frown from having phones at a meeting. I do. But before this meeting, my brother told me that my parents were flying back from Florida, and they didn't bring the gate to the plane like they normally do. They brought the stairs. My mother had fallen down the stairs. So I'm at the meeting, and I have this ill feeling in the pit of my stomach. I don't know what's going to happen. And all I know is, you know, I'm getting text messages, and they're vague, you know? So you feel like the worst, but I'm exactly where God wanted me to be. I was amongst my peers and my loved ones. And I told a couple of people, and they prayed for my mom right then and there. Well, my mother fell down those stairs backwards, hit her head. They took her to the emergency room. They did CAT scans and everything, and fortunately she was okay. That she could have broken her neck. So here again, I had to write this down just to remind myself. She could have broken her neck. She did not. She didn't even have a concussion. So now, you know, I'm starting to write these things out, and I'm like, And here's my third one. My daughter was driving her sister to school and my two godchildren that live down the street. So I live in a corner house, which is also an island. It's the bus stop. My daughter's backing out of the driveway, didn't even notice the huge school bus full of kids. Backed right into it. Here I am thinking, oh my God, is everybody okay? Oh my God, my insurance is going to go up. That was my immediate second thought, because it's about me, I'm selfish. So it says here, the school, my daughters were fine. My godchildren, who happened to also be passengers in that car, they were fine. Everybody was okay. They checked every single one of those kids on that school bus at the school nurses, and they called me back. And they said, everybody's fine, it's okay. Nobody was had any trauma or anything from the accident. And the first thing I thought about was, you know, thank God. Thank God. Because first off, you know, my daughter, she, I think, only had a year of being driving, legally driving. So if this something bad would happen, I know she probably would not have won. She would have been very apprehensive to go behind the wheel again. So for me, one of the things I have right here, the school did not sue me. I have it written down here, so I'm not. So apparently that was, yes. You know, there was like 20 kids, so you figure 20 sets of parents. You know, all it took was one. That's a miracle. Another one I wrote down, my daughter was born at 2 pounds, 13 ounces. The doctors told me she was going to be a dwarf with possible retardation because they said that she didn't have oxygen because they saw they had the breathing apparatus next to her in her NICU, in the incubator. So they said all of these things to me, and it was all worst case scenario. My daughter's 24 years old. She's taller than me. She's 5'2". She's quick as a whip. She does math better. Math is her forte, and me, math and I don't get along. We're divorced a long time ago, and it's okay. But that's a miracle to me. That's a miracle to me. Because here, modern medicine was telling me all of these things that were going to happen with my daughter. And here she is, a testimony that there's something greater that holds the plan. It's not me. And it's not even the doctors. You can be prepared for something, and the doctors can prepare you for something, but ultimately the person that has that plan is not you. So that was another of my miracles. And I have a few more. I'm not going to read them all to you. But as I'm starting to read these now, I'm looking back and I'm like, well, you know what? Maybe I don't have the Midas touch. Maybe I'm just looking at things differently. I'm too focused in being in it than to see the other perspective of it. And that's our disease, right? It's a disease of perception. So now I have that maybe, which is starting to reconnect me with that innocent me that's deep down within me, that faith that I have to acquire. Now, as I'm writing, and the more I log, and I actually, this is a really great suggestion for anybody. Keep writing things down, because it's something when you see it in black and white. Because it's another thing when you're talking about it, and it's latent in your head, but when you actually read it, you're like, oh yeah, I remember that. And it's just, it jumps right at you. And there's something about us physically, we need to have that tangible proof. For me, this was my tangible proof that God has been there. God has not eluded me. So I have that. Now that I have that, I can go and commence my step three. I can't do a step three unless I have that knowledge and I have that willingness. So I was able to do that. Right? So, on page 54, the second paragraph, it says, imagine life without faith, where nothing left but pure reason. It wouldn't be life. But we believed in life, of course we did. But wasn't that how we were living life the entire time anyway? We couldn't prove that life in the sense that you can prove a straight line in the shortest distance between two points, yet there it was. Could we still say the whole thing was nothing but a mass of electrons created out of nothing, meaning nothing, whirling onto a destiny of nothingness? So another way to interpret that is, I'm here, I'm a waste of space. I'm just here because I was put here by the Big Bang Theory or whatever it was. And there's no point of this. So why even bother continue to the next day? Why don't I just end it right now? Or is there something to this? Evidently, I have some faith because they say when you set your alarm clock, you have faith that you're going to wake up the next day. So, and it starts right there. I go to sleep in hoping that I'm going to get up the next day. Sometimes I don't want to get up the next day, but I still do. So what's the plan now? All right, you're up now. You didn't want to wake up. Now what are you going to do? Well, now I succumb to this third step, and I get out of my own way. It says, actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every woman and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or another, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves, in miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives, are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have. I'm sorry, I don't have my glasses. Just as much as the feeling we have for our friends. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but here was there. Here was as much a fact that we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It is within us. So that's where I started, you know, about that innocence I had to find within that little girl within me. And that little girl went through a lot of experiences that forced her to grow up very quickly. But even throughout those experiences, I saw where God was there and never abandoned me. Part of my story is I was sexually molested and abused from ages 4 to 7. So when I was talking about that honesty early on, I said there were things that I learned to omit, because there are certain things that you don't talk about in the house, or, you know, what stays in the house stays in. So all of those lines are already now, if not black and white, what's true, what's not true, what you told me not to say that, maybe I shouldn't say this, and now, forget it. Now that whole border went out the way. I just don't know what the truth is anymore. It's been so long, I don't even remember. That's how I get. So I have to be honest. And I had become very honest with that memory that I had suppressed and I had pushed away. And I talked about it. And the more I talked about it, the less empowering it was of me. I found God in that. I don't know if anybody saw the movie The Shack. There was a part in that movie that to me it was like that eye-opening experience. When the man is saying to God, why did you let my daughter go through this? And why didn't you punish the person that did this to him, to her? And when God turns around and says, I didn't let her go through it. I was there with her. That to me was like, oh my God, light bulb moment. He says, you're both my children. The person that did it and the person that was on the other side. You're both my children. Now, as a parent, I'm a parent. How do I choose between my two kids? When I thought about that, it made sense to me. It was able to help me to, and I was able to see things from a different perspective for my abuser. So I could forgive him. Not that I had to forgive him, but I had to forgive the incident from happening so that that would not be empowering me either. And I was able to do that. Because I know God was there. God held my hand. God guided me through all of that. Because now I'm having this connection with my step three. I'm able to recall a lot of these memories with God in mind. You can remember things and have a recollection of things, but if you don't have that third step, it's going to be entirely different than once you have that third step within you. I can be victim and pray, or I can be a survivor and see how this can continue to blossom and evolve. So once I did my step three, and these miracles, this list of miracles helped, like that moment in the shack when God said, you know, I was with her, I didn't abandon her. And when he answered, I can't choose between my kids any more than you can. You're both my children. Just because one child does wrong, does that mean I have to dispose of them? As a parent, how do you make that decision? So for me, I needed those visualizations because that's what helped me to connect more with the book. So I was like, okay, yeah, I can go with that. I understand that. I have faith in that. I can power through. It says, we can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. This broad highway they're talking about is the highway to the spiritual realm. And I love that being just being led to that promising road, that journey, which about, 15 minutes ago when I started this thing, which is when before I was in step one and two, that journey didn't seem so promising. It didn't even seem like my life was going to have any fun left in it. And now when I'm looking at this broad highway they're talking about, which is the spirit of the realm of the spirit, I'm excited because I have no idea what life has for me. Here I was the one making plans before from when I drank about pre-gaming, post-gaming, getting babysitters and all, and now I am in control of nothing and it feels exciting. There's no tension because I am so tired of being in charge of my lives, in charge of myself, in charge of my children, in charge and micromanaging all of the people around me also. I don't have to do that now because I've done this decision. I made this decision to turn my will over. So I'm not in charge. I'm done. Do it with what you may. I believe that it's going to work out the way it's supposed to anyway. That took a long time for me to get to that. It's going to work out the way it's supposed to be anyway. That means, guess what? If I do something to alter that, I'm not going to change it because I'm not that powerful. That only came with me with the mindset of knowing that I surrendered my will. There's no loopholes. The minute there's a loophole, you're not completely abandoning yourself. You have to make the decision to turn your will over. My sponsor, I love it. He did this to me. He goes, Dee, do me a favor. He goes, open your hand. Everything that you believe right now, all of the knowledge you do, and God, and anything that has to do with a power beyond you, I want you to put it in his hand and close your hand. So, okay. I'm looking at him like, yeah, he's this guy. This guy sponsored me? He's got to be nuts. So he goes, do you think God can open that hand? I said, yeah. He goes, so do you think that if you were to take something back from God, God could take it back? No. He goes, it's up to you to surrender your will. And once you surrender it, there's nobody who could take anything back from God. But you have to entirely abandon yourself and entirely make that decision to say, here, it's yours. I'm done. But if you're doing this and clutching a fish, you're not giving God really what you want. You're not surrendering. But once you do, there's no way God's going to take anything back from you. Because guess what? You can't fight management, and God is management. And when he told me that, God is management, I started thinking like the employer and the employee. I'm like, son of a gun, they got me again. The chapter 2 employer is all about God. God is the employer and we're the employee. How they sneak that one in there, you know? So, yes, I have a new employer. I am a worker bee. For me, my job is to chop wood, carry water. That's what he tells me. D, what don't you do? Question management. Okay. Simple enough. Some days aren't as clear as others, but I always have to remember, don't question management. I know God's plan always is going to happen the way he means it to happen. And I have nothing to do with that. I can try to stick my finger in there if I want, if I think I'm in ego instead of in spiritual realm, if I'm still stuck more into the ego, yes, I can really do myself damage. And it's not healthy for me. I lived that way already too long. This way is so much better. Another thing that has to do with ego, right? Because we're ego, we're self-centric, we're egocentrical, and everything is always about us, us, us. So I have in my notebook written down the letter E, the yin-yang. You know what the yin-yang is, right? So all of us have both, I don't want to say good and evil, because I don't think we have evil, but we have, there are good things, and then there are things that we put too much attention to that we shouldn't. So when I'm caught up in the stuff that I shouldn't be, which are the I's, I should not be doing this. I should have been the one who was chosen to read. I should have been the one. Every time I'm in an I, it's an ego. So I'm stuck in that E. Now he has three circles, the yin-yang up on top, the letter E in a circle, and the S in a circle. And the reason I'm in a circle is because I'm not alone. Okay? My job every day is to try to get a little bit out of the ego and head towards that spiritual circle. I can tell you where I am. And everything I'm telling you is exactly how my sponsor walked me through it. Sometimes I'm closer over here. Sometimes I'm right here by the arrow. I'm never over here completely at spiritual yet. But that's where I'm going. That's where I'm aiming to go, and that's where I want to be. And, you know, it's, guess what? God is in charge of time, too. For me, what a month could be an eternity, for him, it's just like that. That's why everything happens in God's time. Wow, it's so great that I know that now. Some things quickly, some things slowly, they say, huh? To me, it was like forever. It's not slow, it's just going backwards. No, they actually are coming to fruition. Who are you to say there is no God? This man, I'm on page 56 on the third paragraph. This man recounts that he tumbled out of bed to his knees. In a few seconds, he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. It poured over and through him with the certainty and majesty of a great tide at flood. The barriers he had built through the years were swept away. He stood in the presence of infinite power and love. He had stepped from the bridge to shore. For the first time, he lived in the conscious companionship with his Creator. That's where I want to be. Thus was our friend's cornerstone fixed in place. No later vicissitude. There's another word that I looked up. Vicissitude means difficulty, hardships, change or variation in life's circumstances. No later vicissitude had shaken it. His alcoholic problem was taken away that very night years ago. It disappeared. Save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned. And at such times, a great revulsion has risen up in him. Seemingly, he could not drink even if he would. God had restored him to sanity. So we're talking about Bill here, right? So he had to let go of the, God is everything, God is nothing, which he did. And they're talking about when he had that experience, his own spiritual experience. Everybody has their own spiritual one. When he had his spiritual experience, it says, save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink never returned. That sounds to me like a recovered alcoholic. You wouldn't be an alcoholic if you didn't see a drink every once in a while and kind of like romance it. I mean, I still do. But it doesn't, I don't look at it like, oh my God, I could be right next to something, it doesn't even faze me. It does not empower me. That's not my God anymore. It used to be. There are some times I wouldn't be an alcoholic if I said there are some times I didn't fantasize about. Especially whenever you see a commercial or something, it's a brand new drink that just came out. I'm like, what? Why wasn't that around when I was drinking? I do that. In fact, I was doing that yesterday. I was at a restaurant with my parents. And I said, oh my God, that sounds delicious. And my father's looking at me. My father's sweating like, oh my God, is she going to relapse? Yeah, it sounded delicious. That's all I said, you know. They all had their drinks in front of me. It did not faze me or bother me. In fact, we were laughing about it. My father was laughing about it. My father's an amateur drinker, so most of the stuff he was ordering, he goes, what is this? What is that? Here's the alcoholic to let you. Let me break it down to you. This is what you want. This is what you don't want. This is too sweet. So, to me, it's funny that way because they look to me as the bartender alcoholic aficionado. That's I'm their Webster's Dictionary of drinks. So I think you know what, this is going to be a great place to leave it right here at step 3. But I have been restored to sanity as well. I have recovered, which is what they told me. They promised me, right? I have recovered from that hopeless, seemingless state of mind and body. And what a great place to leave it right now. Next thing we're going to do, we'll talk about next week, is we'll start with step 4.